Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Peter Paul Verzola with the New Shadow. We should have our guest on, Patrick Butler, journalist in Chicago, long time, expert on Illinois national politics. This is the March to the Scaffold, which is a theme we're working on. Appropriate place for a lot of politicians and the poverty profiteers and the real estate racketeers. I'm sure some people want to send Bernie Madoff there. So Patrick's going to be with us for about half an hour today because he's on deadline for his paper. Let's see. He should be on. I don't know. He's supposed to call in. He may be calling in late. But anyway, with the exception of two states across this country, ironically, North Dakota, senior senator there is Kent Conrad, who's working on, I believe, the national health proposal, program proposal, and Montana. And Montana has set itself up or decided that it's asserting its state's rights sovereignty. This is going to be very interesting. But those two states apparently are fiscally sound. Now, interestingly, one aspect of the Governor Sanford controversy and scandal is people, nobody really knew much about him. He was a congressman, but he worked for Goldman Sachs, and his wife, who's from Winnetka, Illinois, this is interesting, another Illinois connection, was a vice president, I think, at Laser Frere. She went to Georgetown School. She has a degree in economics or finance, one of the two. And also Sanford worked for Coldwell Banker, the real estate outfit. And he's a captain in the United States Air Force Reserve. I think George Bush Jr. was also a captain in the Air Force Reserve. So I don't know anything further about that. But what's interesting is, Argentina is a long way to go for a love affair. Is there more? One of the questions coming up about the fact that Governor Sanford had rejected the federal stimulus funds was because federal auditors would have to come in and audit the proposed programs of the books of the state. And if the governor rejected the funds, then the federal auditors would not be allowed to come in, or at least come in for those purposes. Although if there are other federal programs like HUD, education, AIDS, the feds have a right and have an obligation to come in and audit the books, although it's very difficult to do. So, there may be more to this Argentine question. Interestingly, people don't realize, or probably don't remember, those of you who don't know history or has forgotten, is Argentine was, according to the Department of Justice's money laundering section, when I covered the American State Bar, back in, what was it, in the 90s, the last time was here in San Francisco, I attended the money laundering session, and Argentina was at the time considered middle level for laundering drug money, real estate money, banking, all that sort of thing. I don't know if any of Madoff's dealings were done with Argentine banks. But of more interest is that Argentina, during World War II, under General Juan Perón, was a refuge for all the Nazis fleeing from Europe who got out through a thing called the Rat Line. And one of the major banks, in fact, the oldest bank in Argentina, the Bank de Provincia of Buenos Aires, has a connection to a major scandal here in California, the Juan Pifferre homosexual predator scandal, which has erupted again in a parole hearing in just recently here in California. And apparently the Nazis who escaped, Martin Bormann, brought or sent over a lot of the loot that was ripped off from Europeans in the European in the occupied countries occupied by the Nazis. And one thing to keep in mind, it wasn't only Jewish people that were ripped off. It was equal opportunity theft. Anything the Nazis could steal, artwork, jewelry, sculpture, money, gold, was stolen. And some of it is supposed to have been buried in a lake in Austria, you know, that nobody's really been able to ascertain that, or if they have, they're keeping quiet about it. But we do know that money was laundered to Argentina, and that bank, which is the oldest and prominent bank, most prominent bank in Argentina, has was one of the repositories. Also the Bank of Canada, other banks around the world, and, of course, the usual ubiquitous Swiss banks. So there's more to the Argentine. That's the other side of the Argentine story, and it goes back 60 years. And it'll continue to go on until it's investigated thoroughly, and a lot of vested interests would like to keep it quiet. But there may be more, as I said, and I was talking to a source yesterday, a Washington source, that there may be another reason that the governor was down there. It seems like we all said it's an awful long way to go for a love affair or whatever, a quickie. So be that as it may, we do have problems here in America. Now, I hear, this is speculation at this point, that there may be a bank holiday late this summer because the banking system is in such a mess, we don't know how to unravel it, or maybe they don't want to unravel it. But we keep hearing about a new coinage, a new currency called the Ameri-something, and it has come up last year. This was part of the deal for the union of the North American, union here, Canada, United States, and Mexico, and I guess the hell with South America. But and, of course, that highway going from Texas up through Kansas, up to the Canadian border into Canada, the Trans-America Highway, and there were supposed to be four others. This was supposed to be part of the plan to, quote, implement this North American Union. So we'll see where that goes, since it takes money to do these things. I believe I have a caller on. And Patrick, are you there?
I am here.
Good, good. It's the first time I'm doing it, so for me. Patrick, tell us a little bit about yourself in the half an hour we got.
Okay. I am a reporter with Pioneer Press. That's owned by the Sun-Times. Previously, I had worked for years as a reporter columnist with Lerner Newspapers, and I'm a fifth-generation Chicagoan, and I've, you know, written a lot of magazine stuff as well. I've just generally found myself in interesting places at interesting times.
With interesting people.
With interesting people, such as yourself.
I know. Well, we used to run around and chase the Chicago police on some things. Remember those days?
Indeed.
Well, we won't get into them.
Indeed.
Not now. We don't have time.
We'll talk about this over a beer sometime.
I'll have a vodka. Anyway, Patrick, now your state, your new governor, Quinn, is that his name?
Yes, it is.
Was on PBS yesterday saying that he wanted to raise the income taxes in your state 50%. Is this accurate?
Well, it is accurate, but the 50% increase, you're talking about an income tax which is like 3.5%. And it's a graduated income tax.
Is that what it is presently before the proposed tax?
Yeah, yeah.
Is it graduated on, like, if you make a 250 thou or a mil or a 25 thou?
I'm not sure exactly what the breakdown is, but what you're talking about, you know, not if the feds were going to raise the income tax 50%. That would be significant. In this particular case, it's painful, especially now, but it's not nearly as painful as what we may see happen if a number of Well, crucial state services have to be suspended because there's simply no money. And as I understand it, this is not intended to be a permanent thing. But then, of course, they always say that. I mean, indeed, the first income tax was not supposed to be a permanent thing when it was instituted during the Civil War. And indeed, they did drop it after a few years, but they brought it back in 1913, again, as a temporary measure, which we've had with us since then.
We also got the Federal Reserve, too, a very controversial banking system.
Yeah.
Was that Andrew Jackson would have been alive at that time? He was probably spinning in his grave.
Yeah, well, Andrew Jackson would have a lot to spin in his grave about right about now.
Patrick, now, I earlier introduced the program saying that, according to the news yesterday, only two states, North Dakota and Montana, are flush with, or not, are solvent. Everybody else has got major money problems, depending on where you look in your state, and my old home state in California, I think. And I just brought up Sanford in South Carolina. There may be more to that little trek to Argentina. We always hear about, Illinois is so corrupt. You've had three governors one governor who was indicted. I think it was Stratton, if you remember that one.
Yeah.
Back in the 50s. And then we had Kerner, controversial Otto, who went to federal prison. And then we have Ryan, and now we got Blagojevich. Is there something?
Oh, don't forget Governor Walker.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, don't forget him. He was the reformer.
For everybody else, you know, it's like transparency. It's for everybody else. You know, it's what I call verbal manipulation.
And then, of course, you know, now we have former Governor Blago, who goes on trial almost exactly a year from now. I believe the case is supposed to come up in July of 2010.
It'll be interesting to see if they request a change of venue to another federal circuit. I think he can do that.
Well, but he has had so much exposure, largely because of his own doing.
Oh, yeah.
Remember, this guy has gone on the Chautauqua circuit, and because of his own doing, I mean, he's kind of become America's new clown prince, and so it's a little hard for him to find a change of venue where he would not be known. The person who really came out looking like gold in this whole thing was Patty Blagojevich, his wife.
Yeah, Patty.
I mean, she gave a good account of herself, even
so far.
Yeah,
we know, just like Mrs. Maddow. Patrick, you know, but getting back to my point that we hear about Illinois being the most corrupt or one of the most corrupt states in the Union and, you know, in its history. But yet nobody really what is it about Illinois that's different from, say, Tammany Hall, San Francisco, Kansas City under the Prendergast, the Green Machine in Philadelphia, and the Curly Machine in Boston? What is it unique about Cook County politics?
Well, I don't think there's that much that's unique about Cook County politics. All of the places that you've mentioned are products of 19th century urban ethnic political machines.
Not San Francisco, though. It's going on here, but it's politically correct.
Oh, if you say so.
It's what they call honest graft.
Oh, okay. Yes, much like the governor of Mississippi who ran for governor about 30 years ago, claiming that, yes, he was going to steal, but he would only steal with one hand.
Where was the other?
And the man got elected.
Well, we've had, remember your famous, infamous mayor, Big Bill Thompson, who got elected by going into the Irish ward saying of King George, was it King George?
King George the Fifth.
The Fifth, okay. If he came to Chicago, he'd punch him in the nose.
Uh-huh.
Is that an
accurate statement? You're absolutely correct.
And he got
Are you there? Are you there?
I'm here. Was that you or me?
I think it was you. Either that or else it was Homeland Security. I'm not sure.
Oh, well, listen, everybody listens to everybody at the KGB. They're still around. We'll talk about them and my experience. In fact, they're on my website, on my video website at YouTube, Russian Diplomats Tips on Avoiding a Hangover. So you're welcome to go and look at that under Amicus Veritas, AmicusVeritas. And this is for everybody in the audience. And it seems to work, what he did to avoid getting drunk, embarrassing his boss, and ending up in a gulag. and there have been diplomats over here. I don't know. Do you know of any cases in your experience where diplomats have gotten drunk and had to be, you know, have their diplomatic status stripped?
I don't know about diplomats getting drunk. I can tell you this much. About 12 years ago here in Chicago, I did an interview with two retired Russian generals, and it was at about 10 o'clock in the morning. And they said they would be glad to talk with me, but first we had to drink a couple toasts in vodka. Now, there
was it Russian?
It was Russian vodka.
It wasn't Smirnoff.
No. It was Stoli. And,
okay.
This was at a downtown hotel. They ordered in the vodka. And there's no way I could keep up with these guys because first they were drinking toasts to my country, to my mother, to their mothers, and so on down the line. And finally I had to bribe the waiter to give me water so that I could keep up with these guys. So while I was drinking water, they were drinking the vodka. They were looking at me to see exactly how I was going to respond to this. I guess they expected that I was going to collapse or say something stupid or whatever. When I continued to do the interview in a fairly rational fashion,
they came away
with a new respect for Americans that, yes, we could hold our liquor. In this case, we could hold our water.
I guess you better follow the James Lynn thing, shaken, not stirred. Well, you know, Patrick, as journalists, now when I was in Australia and Canada, when I landed in
Did you go to Australia voluntarily, or were you...
No, I was honorary. Well, they thought I was Hawaiian, depending where I went, Samoan, Fiji Islander, I mean, everything, but I just said, I'm an American, you know. I carry an American passport. But what was interesting, I was landing in Sydney when Aquino was landing in Manila. Fortunately,
uh-huh.
We weren't on the same plane or going to the same destination.
Uh-huh.
But what happened was I did some interviews and I was chauffeured by Australian government officials because I was over there on quasi-official business to cover environmental and veterinarian things. Anyway, they said to me, you're the new CIA agent on station. And I looked at him and said, I wouldn't be flying coach if I were.
Well, what you really should have said was, I wouldn't be answering that question if I were.
Well, they wouldn't believe me. And I had the same thing happen in Canada when I ran into, I'm sure he was KGB and military with his bearing and how, you know, I was watching the body language from the other members of his, quote, contingent, and we were talking about, do you feed your dog Purina? And of course we did our toasting, but I have learned put some ice cubes in that vodka because you can't keep up with these guys.
Yeah, it's true. And you know, as I say, from now on I bribed the waiter to give me water.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
The other guys drink the vodka.
Is it mineral water?
No, I'm from Chicago. I'm not from California.
Well, you heard now in New York, the restaurants have been told to try to ban imported bottled water, you know, the stuff from Italy and France. Well, you know, I used to joke with the French. I said, how can there be so many bottles of Perrier coming on over here? You know, the Seine is polluted, you know. So they kind of looked at me, you know. But, you know, this is of interest, Patrick, since we're from a bootlegging town. Do you agree with me that Americans don't teach their kids how to drink, and that's why we have so many teenagers?
No, they don't. And that's it really has tragic consequences down the road because, you know, we have some, you know, major drinking problems in this country. We have major drinking and driving problems in this country. And it's really so unnecessary because if people were to be taught how to drink and how to drink responsibly and safely, this sort of thing wouldn't happen.
Oh, I'd agree with you. Pat, let me know, because you said you had, instead of an hour, you said you could only do a half an hour today, and we'll do another one next week.
Yeah.
So how much time do you have?
Oh, we got another 15, 20 minutes.
Oh, okay.
Fire away.
Go ahead, Pat.
Fire away.
Oh, I'm sorry. Don't say that. I'm not Gridley. Patrick,
my granduncle was standing 2 feet away from that.
I was going to get into that. You have an interesting, some interesting characters in your lineage. You want to tell us briefly about your grandfather in the Spanish-American War?
Yeah, my granduncle was an aide to Admiral Dewey during the Spanish-American War, and he was right on the deck there when Dewey gave the order, "You may fire when ready, Gridley." And no jokes, but he later, my granduncle, later became bodyguard to the president.
Which one?
McKinley.
Uh-oh. Now, what's his excuse?
He was not on duty that
day. Sounds like Boston Corbin.
But there was a funny ending to this story. He married a German woman. He eventually spent so much time hanging around in Chicago's German community that he picked up a slight German accent. And during the First World War, when the Super Patriots were making Germans kiss the American flag and all of that sort of thing, he was sitting in a bar, and this one guy came in, heard his German accent. Now, understand, his last name was Butler. He was as Irish as anyone else.
Von Butler.
And, and so he tried to make this former presidential bodyguard kiss the flag, and my granduncle said something in effect that he could kiss something else. And this guy took a swing. That swing was very quickly parried, and the Super Patriot was laying on the ground. The bartender pointed out to the guy that he had just tried to pick a fight with the former bodyguard of the president. And
he lived to regret it.
Be careful. The lesson of the story is be careful who you pick a fight with.
Especially
you may know what
bar.
He's doing. Yeah.
What, Patrick, a little a quick forecast here. What will be the fate, in your opinion, of what's that senator named? Burris? We have another Burris here who's not related.
Okay, Burris is going to serve out this term and then go into a well-deserved, well-financed retirement.
Well, which now, some people think he should serve a term on a federal reservation.
Well, indeed, you know, anything is possible, but they have decided that there is no evidence that he actually perjured himself during the Senate hearings, that his answers may have been incomplete, but that there was not enough there to constitute perjury.
Well, isn't it interesting? Now, what about Jesse Jackson, or Jesse Jive, as we call him, Jr.?
Mm-hmm.
Now, he's resurfaced in the Michael Jackson, what I call this media necrophilia thing. Now, is he still politically influential in Illinois politics?
Oh, you mean Jesse Jackson from Operation Push, not the Congress.
Operation Push, remember when I went down there. Remember?
Right. He's still got some political muscle. He really does, and he's still a fairly significant figure, you know, in the black community.
Oh, okay.
Now he's not as significant as he was in the '60s and early '70s, mm-hmm. when he had reached almost iconic status for supposedly being on the scene when Martin Luther King was assassinated.
Right.
He was not, incidentally. Mm-hmm. He was not there at that moment, but he certainly got there in time to pose for that picture where he was pointing at the direction from which the shots were fired. But no, he's still a powerful political figure.
Another what I call political fiction. In a sense, you know, he touched the hem of the dying Martin Luther King.
Yeah, and
that's his claim to fame.
He's still a very, very charismatic person. He's to be reckoned with.
Okay, well, if you say so, I'm thinking of memories of Al Capone. By the way, is it true that when reporters in Chicago ran afoul of the machine or the mob, that they were taken to a place and treated to a beating with a bar of soap and a sock? Did you ever hear that story?
I don't think that was limited to reporters.
But it is true.
Corporal punishment was not unheard of.
Is that corporal punishment or teaching them a lesson? Well, we had Jake Lingle, one of the characters I always refer to. But wasn't he the one shot on the steps of Holy Name Casino, or was that 1920?
No, Jake Lingle was the one that was shot as he was walking toward a train.
Oh, that's right,
in the Illinois Central Station, right by Randolph in Michigan.
Right.
You should be aware of the fact that Jake Wingle was not the martyr that he was made out to be at the time, but in fact he was playing both sides. In fact,
right, I understand he never filed an article, but he worked for the Chicago Tribune, and I don't understand how Colonel McCormick could have missed that.
Well, I think he did. I think he did cover sports.
Betting.
In fact, he did cover the racetracks.
That's where all that money came from.
And he did write some stuff, but his assignment schedule was somewhat more flexible than would normally have been the case.
You have someone unusual as police chief, a former FBI agent. Is that true?
That's correct.
What's your assessment, or what's the public's perception?
Well, I can tell you this. I can tell you this much: an FBI agent is not a policeman. Okay, they come from an entirely different background. They come from an entirely different mindset. Yes, he was agent in charge of the FBI office in Philadelphia. Yes, he had a credible record as an FBI agent. That's different from being the superintendent of a 13,000 man and woman police force in a major city, going through some, you know, major crime problems at this time. I'm talking about the shootings on the south and west side of Chicago, where you've actually had more people killed on the streets of Chicago than you've had Americans killed in Baghdad.
You know, we don't hear that statistic. We hear, you know, we get...
Baghdad this year.
Right. Well,
okay.
That's
yeah.
There. That's their own problem. Blame it on the British. Blame it on the Brits. They're them and the French. I recommend to people, I always say, look, there's a lot of the Hollywood history, according to Hollywood, depending on how you look, has some interesting films, and Lawrence of Arabia was one of the most accurate.
Yeah.
Say?
Yeah, Lawrence of Arabia, and you know, you and I have seen that about three times together.
Oh, yes,
in fact,
women.
or without, but the fact is that it's pretty accurate, and as accurate as it is, it doesn't begin to reflect the complexities of this guy.
Oh, right. There's another film called another. I have a copy. I'll make sure you get a copy. Extra copies of Lawrence at the peace conference, and how he still insisted that Arabia should be for the Arabians, and the British oil people had other ideas.
Right. And Lawrence in the end didn't realize that he was being used.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He was well used in more ways than one.
Well, yeah. But I mean, the fact of the matter is, his own government was using him to make commitments to the Arabs, particularly the Hashemite family, and knowing full well they were not going to honor those commitments.
Patrick, do you have a big Iranian community in your area?
Not particularly. We do have Iranians here in Chicago, but it's not what I would call a big vocal community. There are some, but it's a very, very minority community here.
Well, there are people now in the New York Times Magazine, which I don't get anymore. They had an article on the son of the late Shah, although he was referred to as that Bedouin. He's saying he wants to go back to his homeland. We lived through that period. You knew the son of a Sawag general. That's the Iranian secret police.
He was not in the secret police.
No,
he was the guy that I knew was the son of an Iranian general.
Oh, okay.
But it was a Iranian regular army general.
Oh, okay.
He was not in Savak. Oh no.
My
no.
Mistake. But I mean, are people, you know, with all of the what I call the Google revolution or the iPod revolution or BlackBerry revolution in Iran,
mm-hmm.
For what it's worth, because media has changed it, what I call the new phase of the Gutenberg revolution. I always said if Paul Revere had a cell phone and, you know, an iPod, he wouldn't have to have taken that ride.
Yes, but what would Longfellow have done?
He'd had to find another subject to write a poem about.
I mean, how can you write a poem to an iPod?
Or a BlackBerry. But now, Patrick, how much more time do you have?
We got about 5 more minutes.
Oh, Patrick, okay. I'll give you this compliment, one of few you've ever gotten from me. You are a real journalist. You really get into a story, and you do as much research as possible, and you've gone to a legitimate journalism school. What was it, Columbia? In
yeah.
Chicago?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What advice would you give to an aspiring student who wants to be not a propagandist, which we're seeing more and more of, but a journalist who can aspire to the likes of, say, Walter Cronkite, Drew Pearson, these are names that probably most people haven't heard in a long time, those type of people.
My first inclination is to say go to law school or start a new religion.
Oh God, we have enough lawyers.
the fact of the matter, and I'm being facetious here,
but the fact
of the matter is, jobs in this business are going to be scarcer and scarcer as time goes on. And you need to pick your niche. You need to find a niche and concentrate on that, because the entry level opportunities are not going to be what they were 20 or 30 years ago. They just aren't. There are about one third of the jobs available today in this business than you had, say, 30 years ago. I mean, we once had 4 newspapers in Chicago.
Right.
New York once had 7. I'm talking about daily newspapers. The average semi-major city had at least 2 daily newspapers. No more. They're lucky if they have 1. And the industry is going through some major changes. It will still be here, but these major changes are going to leave the business totally different than what it had been. Now, the upside of this is those who are in it will have a role in shaping the direction that that business goes.
Now, one of the complaints I get constantly is, people will read a story in what I call the corporate press, like the Chronicle, which is First Zone, and they'll say, this is inaccurate. They call up the writer, and I don't call them journalists anymore because they propagandize out here, or the editor, and they say, I'm on deadline, or blah, 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 and they blow people off. Now, do you think that it's also a problem that the corporate and the alternative media has lost credibility?
Oh, I think what's happening is people are turning more and more toward bloggers and toward online stuff, which incidentally has drawbacks of its own, because a lot of bloggers have their own particular agendas, and likewise a lot of online newspapers do as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think you also have to keep in mind one thing. You talk nostalgically of the days when newspapers printed news and reporters were journalists and all of that sort of thing. But if you look at the turn of the century newspapers put out by William Randolph Hearst and Joseph Pulitzer, and take a look at the front pages of some of those papers, particularly around the time of the Spanish-American War, you talk about blatant propaganda. I mean, they used to crucify people before they even went to trial. We went to war with Spain before there was any clear-cut evidence that the Spanish had blown up the Maine.
Yeah, and we found out 100 years later it was coal dust.
Whatever. I'm not sure whether it was coal dust
or whether
it was the powder.
Internal explosion.
Yeah, the powder in the magazines,
right.
the ammunition magazines.
Which was a common occurrence in those days.
It was a very, very common problem, and
yeah.
It just happened to have blown up at a convenient time for the country to have an excuse to go to war with Spain, which is what they wanted to do in the first place. I can tell you this much. McKinley was not particularly anxious to go to war with Spain, but was told, apparently by some members of Congress, that if he did not, there could possibly be talk of impeachment wafting through the House.
Ah, yeah.
Unconfirmed, mm-hmm. Hearsay, urban legend, family legend, what have you.
Well, with Teddy Roosevelt, wasn't he beating the war drums?
Teddy Roosevelt practically started that war. when he was Assistant Secretary of the Navy, he's the one who ordered the Asiatic Squadron out of Hong Kong into Manila Bay before war had even been declared.
Because
he knew the Spanish fleet was in Manila Bay, and he figured this would give Dewey a leg up after war was finally declared. Teddy Roosevelt, as a matter of fact, tried to get a commission in the Navy.
Oh, I didn't know that.
No, they wouldn't take him because his eyes were so bad.
Right.
So he talked to his friend General Leonard Wood and got permission to form a volunteer cavalry regiment known as the Rough Riders. Now, that volunteer cavalry regiment happened to have distinguished itself at San Juan Hill and in Cuba. And 100 years later, Teddy Roosevelt became the first president of the United States ever to receive the Congressional Medal of Honor.
Kennedy
got the Navy Cross.
The Navy Cross.
Teddy, I have a postcard from Tweed Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt's grandson, who sent me a note after it was decided, and it just says on the postcard, "We did it," because he had told me at a party a year or two earlier that there was a move afoot to give his grandfather the Medal of Honor.
This was posthumously?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, interesting.
Tragically enough, many Medals of Honor are given posthumously. You know, in this case, it's a long posthumous.
Yes,
usually they don't wait 100 years.
Well, I'm sure he would have said bully.
Yeah, he would have liked it. He was
Patrick.
The only...
You saw the film The Wind and the Lion, didn't you?
I saw that. Yeah, it was a great film.
Yeah, I would recommend that. Wouldn't you agree that if people want to understand Teddy, that would be a film to see.
That's a very good one. I would also recommend there was a movie on a made-for-TV movie that came out about 10 years ago, The Rough Riders.
Oh,
now,
right.
Now,
PR and the Rough Riders.
Please understand, The Rough Riders is not a adult film. The Rough Riders is a very, very good account of Teddy Roosevelt and that volunteer cavalry regiment. It's
right.
Very well done, very accurate.
Didn't he, in effect, start his own cavalry regiment or division, whatever it was, and fund it to get it started?
See, in those days, you know, right up until the First World War, practically, if you could raise and equip a regiment, unless there was a good reason otherwise, you could become its colonel.
Ah, so
now,
that's where you got all those Civil War colonels.
Yeah, now there was always somebody right next to you who had been a professional and who knew what he was doing.
Ah.
But you got to be the colonel. And that's where a lot of guys became colonels in the Civil War and some in the Spanish-American War who had virtually no military experience. But they had, either they had or they had friends who had money. And I had often joked, I think with you, that when the 1991 Desert Storm War started, I think I joked with you that if we still had that system, there were enough politicians in Chicago who would have been willing to kick together enough money to, you know, fund the first Illinois Irish Volunteers.
That's because 21
to get
minutes.
Me out of town.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I always thought that if I became president, I'd make you Minister of Public Information.
Well, thank you very much. And as a matter of fact,
it would have been our Goebbels. joking.
Do I get to wear a fancy uniform?
Oh, you can design your own like Goring.
Not that bad.
He actually had
a pink one.
Oh, well, we know about him, the pedophile in the Nazi party. Yeah, and thief.
Why single him out? There were so many.
Yeah, well, that's going to come up again. Patrick, do you have to leave? Because it's 20 minutes.
I do have to leave.
Okay.
I do have to get back to work.
Okay, well, yes. Back to the presses. They've got to roll.
Exactly. And it's been a pleasure, and let's do this again soon.
Oh, we will, and we'll discuss, so we'll extend to other formats. Have a happy 4th of July. Don't get blown up, and don't blow up anybody.
And the same to you.
I'm going to be a recluse this weekend.
We will be talking.
We just had the gay parade, and we'll get into that next week.
No, you can get into it. I will not get into it.
I don't mean that way. Uh-oh, mistake. Slip of the tongue. Fortunately, it was only the tongue.
You have a good one.
Take care, Patrick. Thank you for being on the show.
Sure.
Bye-bye. Okay. Well, that was Patrick Butler. It's P-A-T-R-I-C-K. I'm sorry. Misspelled there. It was a slip of the computer. Anyway, he's been a longtime journalist in Chicago. He has interviewed everybody from presidents to popes or would-be popes. And, you know, comes from a family which he disclosed has deep roots in American history. And that's one of my favorite subjects that we do not understand and don't even know a lot of even our own history. And if you don't know your own history, it often is repeated, and the second time around is often worse. So I would suggest to people that you do some reading and see a lot of the films are, like I said, history according to Hollywood. Depends how you know which film is put out. At least gives you an insight. And now we're still, putting a lot of emphasis on Afghanistan, and people still do not understand the history of that country. I'm just getting my software, getting the kinks out, no pun intended. You know, these computer people who put this software together, you want to kill them because they do it. They make it complicated and with all these avenues that, just for fun, they have nothing better to do, and they charge you an arm and a half a leg to get the program. But I do have the last commanding general of the Bengal Lancers. I've brought this up several times. And I was going over it was a long interview I did with him about an hour before he died in the late 80s. But we got into my favorite subject up in that part of the world, the Northwest Frontier, as it was called, when the British were the colonial power in India. And Pakistan did not exist at that time. But, Pakistan is only 50 years old. It is a creation of the split. When India became independent, Lord Mountbatten, famous admiral, uncle of the queen, part of that German family, which was called Battenbergs, and after World War I, or during World War I, because of the German connection coming from Queen Victoria's husband, that they changed their name to Mountbatten, and then later part of the family changed their name to Windsor, but they're really Battenberg, they're really Germans. And, of course, those of you who've seen the film Tom Jones, the American film with Tom Finney, there's a scene in there with a Squire Weston, I think, or Allworthy, something like that, and he's got a lovely daughter, Susanna York, and he has a sister who is a Presbyterian, and in those days, this was after the split, this cutoff from Henry VIII cutting off the Catholic Church and setting up the Church of England or Anglican Church. There's a line in the film which is delightful where he's lying with his dogs and his wenches, and his sister is chastising him, saying, "Get up out of your stupor." And he says to her, "I'd rather be anything than a bloody Presbyterian." We get an idea of the history of that time and how it later these people came over and colonized America, or depending on how you want to look at that. But, again, people today, and you look at this third generation of kids, and this whole business of I'm an African-American, I'm a Hispanic-American, it's really ridiculous. In my own family, my sister married a boy whose name was Polish, but the family has German, French, Polish, and Mohawk in their immediate ancestry. And how do you put that on my nephew's passport? How is he going to put that on his passport? I'm always, or anybody else. And even today, getting back to the history of England, when the Saxons were overcome by the Normans in 1066, William the Conqueror, or William the Bastard, as he was called, and he was one, he wasn't legitimate, and he's very brutal, they imposed the new order on the Saxons, who were the dominant tribe in that part of the world, in England and Wales. Today, people who have descended, there was intermarriage, and you see names like Olivier. These are people who descended from the Normans, and like De Havilland, the big aircraft company in England. I don't know what they're making now, but that's all French descent, Norman descent. But you don't see on a British passport, if you've ever seen one, Saxon Britain, a Norman Britain, or a Jewish Britain, or any of that. It's just British. And, of course, the language is delightful. And I suggest if you have British friends or whatever, or you know somebody and they've got a passport, ask them to show it to you. It's very beautifully written in very lovely English. But it's none of this hyphenated Brits. And I think we need to get away from that. This is a very special country. I really believe that God shed his grace on this country, even though more and more of the people don't believe in God, but the almighty dollar. But all these people came here for various reasons, whether they were transported as indentured servants or they were transported as slaves. And incidentally, the term high yeller, you will hear that among black people today, some black people who remember what the term means. And that means a person whose ancestry that a Caucasian had messed around with, most probably a woman. We didn't have as much homosexuality in those days as we have today. At least there's very little written about that subject. But that is the result of usually a woman who was taken as a belly warmer. And used to be said in the South, and some of my relatives are from the reservations in Tennessee and North Carolina, on my mother's side, that the term a Southern boy would be told, if you want to learn about life and sex, you get yourself a black girl. And I'll leave it at that. But this is where that term comes from. And as you see light-skinned blacks today, and they have a problem, they're like in a Netherland. This is look at Obama. His mother was white, and his father was Kenyan. Here's a perfect example, the highest example, and although his presence in the White House is controversial with all this birth certificate, I wish he'd just end it all and produce the birth certificate, and either it's genuine, or he's got a genuine one, he was born in Hawaii, and shut people up so he can get on with all the problems that we have in this country. And, you know, they're not going to go away. They're going to get much worse. They're like a cancer that's festering. But again, we are a resilient people, and with July 4th coming up, or actually, it's July 3rd when the Declaration of Independence was signed. We should try to come together. Nixon said that, and then of course it didn't work out. But to realize that we are Americans, we are very special people. We've got the talents and the faults of every racial ethnic group on this planet. But we've all managed to live together in a beautiful mosaic. And yes, we've had our race riots. Yes, we've had our economic disasters. Yes, we've had our depressions. But we always managed to bounce back. And whenever I travel, like I was earlier said, I was a correspondent in Australia and Canada, New Zealand. There's something special about Americans, or they used to be. Of course, I haven't traveled abroad in a while. But we're looked on as something special, and I think there's an envy there. That, hey, you're an American, you've got it made, and your country will protect you. It may not be the same today. But these are things that we should look at, the positive side. Try to stress what is positive in this American culture. And we'll overcome the problems. We'll overcome the inequities. We'll advance. I mean, look at how our courts, our military, our industry, the ethnics have broken through the glass ceiling. We now see more blacks who were discriminated against. In fact, Patrick mentioned Teddy Roosevelt. One of the black things he did, black marks, and I'm using a different term as a criticism, there was a Negro, it was called Negro in those days, battalion in, I think, Brownsville, Texas, when he was president, and there was a race riot down there, and he blamed it on the black regiment, and he dismissed them all from the military. Just total. And no court, no fair trial, no due process. So, and he had some interesting racial ideas. In San Francisco, when the Asians started to come in, the Chinese and the Japanese, we had a famous case of Japanese American Citizen League versus the San Francisco School Board, which was discriminating against Japanese. And Teddy had this very weird idea about the different qualities and failings of the ethnic groups, the races. That he referred, one of the reasons, he's the only president also who got a peace prize for ending the Japanese-Russian war in 1905. There's a rare film. It's the only one out, and it was made in Japan, called The Battle of the Tsushima Straits, where the Russian fleet, and this is one of the great circumnavigation feats in history, where the Russian Baltic fleet sailed around in 1905 from the Baltic, circumnavigated the globe. Nobody would help them because everybody supported the Japanese. And they came through the English Channel. It was very difficult for them. And they came around all the way around. There was no, I don't think they went to the Panama Canal. They had to go around Africa, South Africa there. And they ended up off of, Vladivostok, that area. And the Japanese fleet, of course, was in home waters, and they were training, and they had British guns and the British-built ships. By that time, the Russian Navy, under Admiral Radzinsky, were tired of the 5,000-mile circumnavigation, and they were defeated. Only three ships of the entire Baltic fleet got away, and that was the Japanese Army and Navy were able to overcome the Russians in that part of the world. And so Teddy Roosevelt, in his racist thinking, decided he can't have a yellow race, Japanese, defeating a white race, the Russians. So he brokered this peace treaty, I think, at Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And he got the Nobel Peace Prize for that, the only president ever to get a peace. No, Carter later. Carter and I think Begin. But at that time. Now, the other thing that he did, he always looked at the Chinese. The Chinese have been emigrating or fleeing China ever since the Boxer Revolution, also about that time. And there's another interesting movie that you can get, I think it's come out on DVD, with one of my favorite actors, Charlton Heston, who was tutored by my speech teacher, Professor Dolly Farnstrom, at Wright College in Chicago. 55 Days at Peking. It'll give you an idea of all of the internal struggles and the fights among the various clans and groups in China when the West was trying to carve up the country, the British, the French, the Germans, and that was the end of the Manchu dynasty. So I'd recommend that film, 55 Days at Peking. It's fairly accurate and very, very entertaining, to say the least. But when the Chinese, a lot of them came in illegally, brought their opium into San Francisco and Vancouver, British Columbia and Seattle, they were looked upon as dirty, and Teddy Roosevelt used to refer to them as those G.D. damn dirty Chinese, and whereas he looked at the Japanese as plucky little Japs. So that was this interesting mindset there of that president. Interesting guy, and as Patrick just told you, his family was connected to that war through serving on the ship that Dewey was his flagship. But it's a lot of history. And I would recommend, if you have a military museum in your area, like if you're like in Illinois, I don't know if it's still open, but Colonel Robert McCormick of the McCormick Reaper family, and they're the ones that put Abe Lincoln, got the Republican nomination and put him in the White House in a way. They owned the Chicago Tribune, and Colonel McCormick was called a colonel because in World War I he was commanded a division in France, and he won a battle at Catigny, C-A-T-I-N-Y. Well, after the war, he brought over, like Citizen Kane, you'll see that movie, brought over all these military artifacts and World War I memorabilia to his estate, and he called it Catigny. It's in the western suburbs outside of Chicago, and if you're in that area, you should visit it. A lot of people don't know about it. And there'll be some other military museums and other things I will be bringing up. We're putting a big emphasis on video, and there's a lot of things here in the Northern California area, even though under the Base Realignment Act, under the Nixon administration, a lot of things were closed and a lot of the artifacts have been removed or have disappeared. But I do have photos. We do have video. It has to be edited down, and I'm adding the stuff from our audio archives, which we put together when I was at Western Public Radio and KLWFM, a rare German broadcast, a lot of military people who have retired. You know, it's interesting. I'm surprised that the BBC hasn't picked up on this, that a lot of the retired British officers don't retire in England. They retire in California, so the sun never sets on the British Empire in a way. The other thing that's interesting for those of you who are veterans or those of you who are engaged, have military family or have family in the federal military, that unlike the British, that when the man dies, the veteran dies, or the woman, since we have more women in the military, the money continues, or should continue. In Britain, and this case came up in Brigadier Ingalls' case, famous general who lived here in the Bay Area, his wife, his pension was cut off, ceased when he died back in the late 80s. And I didn't know that. So that's one of the interesting differences between different militaries and how they treat their survivors. But it's one of the things that's unique, and we should appreciate our federal military and even our National Guard. These guys and women have to give up their jobs to go out and, you know, fill sandbags when there are floods, or increasingly go to fill in the spaces in our federal military in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. I don't know if it's a good idea. There is a famous U.S. Supreme Court case that came out of Minnesota. They had a governor named Perpich, P-E-R-P-I-C-H, and I think it was Reagan had nationalized the Minnesota Air National Guard to go down in South America and support, suppressing insurrection or whatever down there. So Perpich, Governor Perpich, said, no, you're not going to be allowed to use our Air National Guard for your foreign adventures. So the case went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and again, and this is still not respected, especially in places like San Francisco, that the Supreme Court said that it is the federal government that has the supreme authority, the final authority, over how military forces shall be used and how they shall be raised. And that's part of a basic part of the U.S. Constitution. Now, a case that's just coming out, again, we've been quiet about it. It's a 13-year case, and if you go to Cashel.com, and I'll put up the links on my blog, amicusveritas.org, amicusveritas.org, and on our video at YouTube, the same, amicusveritas. The former U.S. Navy sailor who was stalked in 1996, he was an 18-year-old kid, barely 18, never drank, Native American, and you know those of you who have that blood, that they have don't have that gene that enable them to handle their liquor. He was stalked, lured, in effect, date raped, drugged, and raped, and he was lured to this Argentine neo-Nazi's house, illegal alien also. And, in effect, raped, and he fought back, and the guy had cocaine in his system and a heart condition, and he had done this to other military personnel and other youth. In fact, we discovered that he had said at the party that night that he was going out looking for a young white boy. And he lured this kid there and lured him into a sex act. The kid could not fight back because he had the date rape drug in his system. This was suppressed. So he got railroaded by our kangaroo courts here in San Francisco, and believe it or not, if a heterosexual person or even a person who's asexual gets into a conflict with a homosexual, especially that homosexual or lesbian is politically or judicially connected, that person, the heterosexual or the asexual, will be railroaded, and it's happened in 4 or 5 cases, which we have documented. So if you're coming to San Francisco, be very careful and don't get in these situations. And don't go to these clubs or areas where you're likely to be preyed upon. And you will not get your civil rights protected in this town currently. It's a damn shame, but that's the way it is. We'll be getting more and more into this because what people need to realize that when a person is in prison, whether they're guilty or not, there are huge costs that go on through the trial, incarceration in the state or county prison, county jail, state prison, parole, a dislocation of the family, the person is can't get a job. So these are things we will be getting into, the uneconomics of railroading innocent people. And more and more people are beginning to realize this is what's going on by these corrupt prosecutors who want to make themselves look good so they'll have a job and they can enjoy that $100,000 plus income. And if they're into vice, cocaine or little boys or pornography, and that is becoming more apparent among some of these corrupt prosecutors, especially here in California. And that has been documented, these people. So again, have a happy 4th of July. Don't blow up anything, pun intended. You know, and take some time to learn about your history, our history, and your children, what will be or what should be your children's history. I want to thank you for listening, and we hope to have more guests learning this system. And I hope the music wasn't too loud, and we'll be offering rare audio clips from the archives, the Verzola archives, that was put together at Western Public Radio and KLW-FM, and the interviews, you know, relevant things, like the general who put together the Mulberry Bridges at Normandy. He also died here in San Francisco. So we have a lot of that, a lot of rich history. We'll try to make this eclectic program interesting and also give you practical tips. And we'll be doing some things on summertime driving, how to protect yourself from auto accidents and lawsuits. Thanks for listening. This is Peter Paul Verzola. Okay. 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 Okay.